shrimp, veggie stir fry. A summer specialty, icy bean noodles. Shinmi Chinese restaurant has everything.
History happened everywhere. Hello, my name is Ryan Weir, and I am here in the HHE studio with the jade rabbit to my Peking duck. It's Mr. Peter Goddard.
Is a jade rabbit some sort of Gwyneth Paltrow sex aid?
Yeah.
Oh.
Moving on. Now, Peter, last week the Dursalator gave you nutrition in China during the 2nd century. So, what oriental delights have you got in store today for the listeners to take away?
Aha, I see what you did there. Well, today, Ryan, we're going to the Far East to discover China, ancient civilization and modern-day economic powerhouse, in order to discover nutrition in 100 to 200 CE, also known as the Eastern Han Dynasty. We're going to look at China in China, and we're going to meet the lady leader who made sure her people had enough to eat. We're going to discover the many wonders of a Chinese superfruit, and we're going to open the golden cabinet of a Han Dynasty physician who'll balance your yin and your yang. It's China, Ryan. It's 100 to 200 CE, and it's nutrition. So get ready for a healthy diet of facts and fun. Welcome to China!
Let's say China, 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 China.
Let me ask you about China.
China, China.
All right, well, lots of things to look forward to there, Pete, as mysterious as they are. But look, why don't you start with the obvious? Tell us about China.
China is a country in East Asia. So if you start in Japan and head west, leap over the Koreas, you will hit China. Or you can start in India and go north. Or you can start in Russia and go south. Or you can start with, do you know what? It's got land borders with 14 different countries. So I'll stop there.
China's big.
Exactly my point. China is big, very big. The third biggest country by area after Russia and Canada.
How about that?
Yeah, that's 9,596,000 square kilometres, 3,705 square miles. That is 1,640% larger than France. In other words, you will need 17 Frances to make a China.
Yeah, that's a big place, isn't it?
It is a very big place. And it's populous. Controversially, the second most populous nation. I say controversially because for a very long time, it was the most populous nation since the 1950s at least. But in April 2023, it was overtaken by India as the most populous nation.
Wow, okay.
1.4 billion people, Ryan, if you can imagine that.
I cannot.
I can help you with that. If you take the population of China and they take it into turns to listen to one episode of HHE podcast,
yep,
it will take them 159,707 years to finish listening.
But what a great time they would have.
Yeah, they better pick a good episode is my advice. The official language, Ryan, is Standard Chinese, which is a standardized version of Mandarin Chinese.
Okay. What does that mean?
Well, it's Chinese, basically, but it's there are a number of different versions of Chinese. You've got Cantonese, which is Chinese, but this is a formal, standard, official Chinese in China. It's a tonal language. It's quite different to English, so I will begin with the much-needed apology for the following pronunciation of names and places that you're going to hear throughout today, despite the best efforts of ChineseNamesInEnglish.com, which I consulted considerably for this episode.
I'm sure you did.
It's going to be a rough ride, I'll warn you now. Religion-wise, the country is officially atheist, but its constitution does guarantee freedom of religion.
Freedom of religion, okay.
So I'm told that Buddhism leads the pack with 33% of the people, 25% profess no religion, 20% are Taoists, there's 18% other folk beliefs, and that leaves just a few percent of Christianity, Islam, and all the rest.
I mean, I guess in country that large, there's a lot of rural areas, right?
Yes.
Where they will still have a lot of the ancient customs and traditions and myths.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a huge place, such a diverse place with rural and urban and modern and perhaps not so modern. So what is perhaps underreported is the Christianity and Islam. I'm not sure it was necessarily encouraged, so that may not be wholly accurate numbers.
A lot of Buddhists though, eh?
A lot of Buddhists. Now the flag, Ryan, is very distinctive. I'm sure you'd recognise it. It's a big red flag with a large yellow star in the top left or hoist corner with four smaller yellow stars in an arc just to the right of that.
Yeah, I've seen that before.
You could probably work out what the red represents.
Blood.
No.
Fortune.
Think of the modern China.
communism.
Yes, communism. Yeah, the big yellow star represents the Communist Party, and the four little stars supposedly represent the social classes. That's the proletariat, the peasants, the petty bourgeoisie, and the patriotic capitalists. Now, this flag was designed by someone called Zheng Lian Song. They're described in Wikipedia as, quote, a Chinese supply chain manager and secret agent of the Chinese Communist Party, but also apparently a flag designer, so a man of many talents there.
It's not a very complicated flag, though, is it?
Well, that's the joy of a good, well-designed flag. It's distinctive and simple, I think. And the official debut was when this flag was raised by the People's Liberation Army by Tiananmen Square in Beijing on the 1st of October 1949.
Cool. Tiananmen Square. Did anything else happen there?
Well,
familiar.
It will pop up again later. Now, anthem. I know you like an anthem, Ryan, and I think this is a good one. So an upbeat beginning. This is called the March of the Volunteers, which is a rather tightened up, snappier version of the original title, which was March of the Anti-Manchukuo Counter-Japan Volunteers.
It's a lot chipper than I would have thought.
It's very chipper. This was inspired by a rise in nationalism after Japan invaded Manchuria in 1931. The lyrics are by a playwright called Qian Han. They were written in 1935. They weren't intended for the national anthem. They were part of a poem originally, and it was set to music by the composer Nie Er.
Quite the upbeat tune.
It's a good, isn't it? I like this one.
Yeah.
Right, China facts. The first one, Ryan, is, I think, a great pub quiz question, which is, how many time zones does China have?
I bet it's a trick question.
A little bit.
So it's going to be either, I reckon it's going to be one or like 18.
You are 50% correct. It is one. China's got one time zone, even though it's big enough to accommodate five different time zones. They decided, no, we're not going to do that. The whole country is on China Standard Time, despite the fact that, obviously, it's very big. So in some areas of the country, it gets to 3 p.m., and that's your noon.
Right. How do you do business like that? That seems really strange.
Well, you stay up, I guess.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah.
Now, Ryan, I wanted to talk about things that China is famous for. And the first one is
China plates.
Exactly, it is. I've chosen China plates to talk about. China is another name for porcelain, so plates and cups and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Porcelain was first made in China, and the secret for it was really jealously guarded. During the Ming Dynasty, the Chinese started exporting porcelain to Europe, and then Europe went mad for it, which I guess is why the classic expensive antique is a Ming vase, because it was in the Ming Dynasty.
Ah, okay. Very delicate and beautiful.
It is delicate and beautiful, and it's difficult to make. And basically in Europe, porcelain becomes more valuable than gold. The European countries go mad trying to figure out how to make it. They try and steal texts that talk about it. They even try and kidnap people who know about the process in order to learn how to make their own porcelain, but they can't do it until 1710. So they keep it secret for a good couple hundred years.
Which is remarkable, really.
It's incredible.
You'd think that someone would have worked it out in that time. Just even give me a bunch of clay and I reckon I could work it out in 50 years.
Well, that's what they thought, and they were quite wrong. Until 1710, a German called Johann Friedrich Bottger, who was an alchemist, in fact, working on the Philosopher's Stone, but he eventually discovered the secret of porcelain manufacture, and they founded the Meissen Porcelain Manufactory, keeping the method a secret themselves so they could also make porcelain.
Never got the Philosopher's Stone, then?
No, he did not make that, but he did pretty well. He turned something else into gold.
Sat down at his potter's wheel. Just try my hand at something else.
But sadly, the secret would not stay down. 2 years later, 1712, a chap called Father François Xavier d'Entrecolle, who was a French Jesuit, went around converting Chinese people and then said, do you know, while we're here, do you know anything about making porcelain?
And eventually, just as an aside.
Just out of interest, really. And then out of interest, he published a letter which told people how to make porcelain, and the porcelain cat was out of the bag.
So how do you make it? What's the trick? I want to know now.
Part of the key was the clay. Kaolin clay was the kind of clay they used, and the other part was the heat. They had to get temperatures incredibly high to fire the china. How they did that exactly, I don't know.
Okay.
Other famous China things, Ryan, are walls. Big, beautiful walls.
I was going to say pandas.
There are also pandas. No, but I want to talk about the Great Wall of China. It is a big wall, a big, beautiful wall, but it is not visible from space. That's a popular myth. So the wall wasn't built in one go. It was originally a number of walls. So it's a bit of a ship of Theseus of a wall. Some of it's really, really old. There's a section of really ancient wall in the Shandong province that's made of just packed up soil, hard, dense soil, that's believed to be about 2,500 years old.
Which is really old.
That is very old.
So that's when they first started making the wall?
That's bits of wall. But really, it was around 220 BCE when Qin Shi Huang, first emperor, kind of united China. He decided to bring all the different bits of wall into one big mega wall. And even then, though, it was mostly earth and wood. But it was the Ming Dynasty, again, in the 1300s, who actually started to build the platforms and watchtowers and yeah. that we think of when we think of the wall.
But did they make it out of crockery?
Yeah,
it's a very delicate wall.
The porcelain wall was a disaster. They had to rethink that.
The thing about building a wall, though, right, is you've got to start building a wall, and that means you're going to have sides to your wall, which means you can just walk around it.
Yeah, there must have been certainly areas where you go round. I guess it's happened throughout history, hasn't it? Like even as far as the Belgians building a nice defensive line that the Germans went round in World War II.
Yeah, until you put that last brick in, anyone could slip through.
Yeah, but at least you know where they're coming, at least. You've channeled them into a certain area so you can put your troops there.
See, that's why you would make a good commander in the army.
I doubt that very much. Now, depending on how the wall is measured, it stretches somewhere between 4,000 and 5,500 kilometres. That's 2,500, 3,400 miles. 2 million grand pianos end-to-end, Ryan. That's what you've got to picture.
Yeah, I can picture that. And that is a lot.
It's a lot of grand pianos, right?
Side to side or keys to tail?
Keys to tail.
I made tail up, but it feels right.
It does sound right, doesn't it? No, this is keys to tail, not side to side.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for clarifying.
Weirdly, I did actually make that decision.
You did? Okay.
Another famous Chinese thing. I thought I'd do something unexpected, Ryan.
Pandas.
No, basketball players.
That is unexpected.
Yao Ming was a basketball player who played for the Shanghai Sharks before moving to the NBA to play for the Houston Rockets.
Right.
He was named the All-NBA team 5 times, and he is 7 feet 6 inches tall.
That is pretty tall, isn't it?
It is. There are many other famous Chinese people, of course, including Confucius, a philosopher from about 500 BCE. He's often quoted. I'm sure you've heard of him.
Yeah, I have. I must admit, I thought he was made up.
No, he's a real person. Part of the difficulty with Confucius is a lot of things get attributed to Confucius. He's one of those magnets for all sorts of different quotes. I saw on the internet was, "It is easy to see the light switch once the lights are on." I don't think Confucius was using light switches. But I did collect a few words of wisdom from Confucius that I think are legit, but I wouldn't necessarily swear to them.
Hit me with them.
First one is, the journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step.
I mean, it's not wrong.
It's not wrong, is it?
You've got to start somewhere. We were just saying that about the wall.
Exactly. You've got to put that first brick down somewhere, haven't you?
Right, exactly.
Okay, the next one. Silence is a true friend who never betrays.
It's not a friend for us on a podcast, is it?
No, indeed. It's a terrible podcaster, but a good friend.
Yeah.
And finally, a man who has committed a mistake and doesn't correct it is committing another mistake.
Oh.
What?
So what happens then?
Well, then...
What if you just keep going?
I guess you should have a word with yourself, ultimately.
That was his follow-up to that one.
Yeah, that was... I think it was, yeah. Have a word with yourself, my son.
And turn the lights off when you leave the room.
A more modern famous Chinese person, Ai Weiwei.
Ai Weiwei?
Ai Weiwei is a contemporary artist. I actually saw one of his works at the Tate Gallery. It's called Sunflower Seeds, which was 100 million individually handmade porcelain sunflower seeds. It was amazing.
He never made 100 million handmade sunflower seeds.
He may have outsourced some of the making of the seeds.
Yeah.
Okay, and my final famous Chinese person is Fan Bingbing.
Of course. Actress.
Actress who's been in many things, but I know her from the film X-Men, Days of Future Past, where she played Blink.
Oh, right. What was Blink's special power?
Blink seemed to open sort of portals in space, I think, and people could pop through them.
Oh.
I'm not clear on the details, but what I must say is I only really included her in this list so that I can say that I'm a big Fan Bingbing fan.
Yay!
That's all I wanted to do. That's why she's there. And the final famous Chinese thing, Ryan, I have to say, is Chinese
pandas.
Food. No, I'm not doing pandas.
Oh.
Chinese food, Ryan, is my final famous Chinese thing. I bring that because the Chinese people spread around the world. They brought their cooking with them, so you can find Chinese food across the globe, really.
Mm.
But my main reason for bringing it up is researching this episode was particularly difficult because every search I made would bring up a bunch of Chinese takeaways in various places.
Oh, nutrition in China. It's going to bring up Chinese food. I see. Okay.
But, you know, if you do need to know of any Chinese restaurant, more or less anywhere in the world now, I think I've probably Googled it at some point.
So Chinese food, international. internationally, is it very different to Chinese food back home? Like, well, I'm thinking Indian food, for example, has kind of evolved since it's been brought to the UK and other places, and you know, new dishes have been created abroad rather than at home.
Absolutely. I was told that on TikTok there was a particular trend for people in the US basically laughing at British Chinese food for being so weird. And I think that's a sign that actually, as you go into different areas, you modify your food for various audiences. Mm. But even within China, it's such a big place. There are local cuisines. Mm. So Chinese food, even saying that, is a bit like saying European food, isn't it?
Yeah. Can you eat panda?
If you're determined enough, I don't doubt you can.
It's probably really illegal, isn't it?
Probably you can do it, but I don't think it's probably affordable.
I just think they're easy to catch. Super slow, super friendly.
Hard to find, though.
That is true, yeah.
Panda Express is a thing. I suppose you can have that.
There you go.
So there you go, Ryan. That is China. Do you know where you are?
I do. I'm fully oriented.
Excellent.
Hey! Hey, Pete.
Hey, Ryan.
You know what? I love fortune cookies.
Oh, yeah, me too. They're great.
It's like a prediction of the future and a tasty treat.
Well, I do agree they are tasty, but I don't think they predict the future, do they?
Yeah, no, they definitely do. Here, let's try one. Okay, this one says, man who munch on cookie will discover jujube. What's that? What's jujube?
I don't know. That's a bit of a mystery, isn't it?
All right, well, look, you try one.
All right, here goes. Okay, this one says, the concubine will become the empress.
Well, that's odd.
Yeah, is it a metaphor for something, do you think?
I don't know. Try another one.
The wise man balances hot and cold for a long and healthy life. Honestly, these are just nonsense.
This one says, a sketch must end, but the show must go on. What's that all about?
I don't know, but this one's even worse. It's written in Chinese or something. It says, d-d-d-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na. Well, how can that predict the future?
No idea. All right, Peter. Well, look, you have walked us through the basics of China. Get richer. Tell us about its history.
History-wise, the Wikipedia entry on this topic says, the history of China spans several millennia across a wide geographical area. So we have a choice of either being here for a very long time or really summing a lot of things up very briefly.
I want all of it.
I'm going for the latter, I'm afraid. I'm not going to spend 2 hours doing the history of China.
Okay.
Culture first emerged in China in the Yellow River Valley, which is actually now considered one of six cradles of civilization across the globe.
That's kind of cool.
There was an early civilization called the Early Two Culture. This was a Bronze Age society in the Yellow River Valley from approximately 1900 to 1500 BCE.
Okay.
At the same time, this period is also said to be the start of the first of the Chinese dynasties. Now, this is worth mentioning that Chinese history tends to be divided into dynasties. So you don't talk about the century necessarily. You're more likely to talk about the dynasty, the Han, the Ming, the Song dynasties, much as we'd talk about the Tudors and the Stuarts in the UK.
Yeah.
So traditionally, the first of the dynasties is supposed to be the Xia dynasty, which dates from about 2070 to 1600 BCE, which puts it at the same time as the Early Two culture, which causes some debate. Basically, there are some people who say the Early Two was the Xia. Some people say the Xia dynasty is actually just a mythical thing. It never really existed. Mm. So it's debatable. So you can pick one, whichever of those you like, because I couldn't find a determined certain answer to that.
Good. I like the idea that at some point there was just a tribal leader and he was like, all right, it's a dynasty now.
Yeah, well, that's all it takes ultimately, isn't it?
Everyone goes, yeah, all right, sounds good.
As long as everyone agrees, then that is so. So in any event, the Xia dynasty is replaced by the Shang dynasty. So what happens is the Xia dynasty is displaced by the Sheng dynasty in 1600 BCE. So this is really the first definitely real for real dynasty. And the Sheng dynasty stays on top of the heap for 600 years, including inventing writing in the process. They are in control when the earliest surviving written Chinese dated back to about 1250 BCE.
That's impressive, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really impressive. There is a lot of history in China. And actually, the Shang dynasty is sometimes known as a golden age of China, which I was like quite impressed by when I came across it. And then I continued my research and I found out that there are over 40 different periods in China considered to be various golden ages. So it's a bit less impressive than I first thought. Now, in 1046, the Sheng were overthrown by the first Zhou king. They were only Zhou king. Genuinely, that was an accidental pun in my script. That ended the Shang and started the Zhou dynasty. And that was an absolute belter. Knocked the Zhous into a cocked hat. It clocked in at 790 years from 1046 to 256 BCE.
That's kind of crazy, isn't it?
That's an astonishingly long time to be in control of one place, right?
Yeah. I mean, I'm guessing you evolve and adapt as you go, but it's really impressive that you've got, what, I guess, one group of people?
Yeah, I think it's more of a clan than a very nuclear family, so it's a more diverse. But yeah, it's okay. An amazing period for one group to be in control of that. But it doesn't last forever. As ever, these things come to an end. 476 to 221 BCE, we have the Warring States period. So the Zhou start fighting amongst themselves, basically, and everything falls apart. And this ends with the armies of the Qin, who win out and start the Qin dynasty.
Chins, hands.
Yes, yes. There's all sorts of body parts available. In contrast to the 790 years of the Zhou rule, the Qin dynasty lasted 15 years.
Wait, what? That even counts. I mean, that's just a blip.
Well, what's funny is that although it only lasted 15 years, it was really significant. It's kind of the beginning of a recognisable imperial China. It expands into the territories around it. They established bureaucracy. They standardised written scripts. They standardised weights and measures. And they're kind of the first real single China that we have in history. So even though they only lasted a small time, they're incredibly influential. In fact, even the name, this is debated by people, but some people think the name China comes from the Qin dynasty even.
Oh, that's very cool. Yeah, do you know what? I didn't put that together.
And do you know what? This 15-year period also gave you the Terracotta Army, which is the tomb of the Qin Emperor Qin Shi Huang.
Okay, it dates back that far.
Yeah.
Okay. So what on earth were the others doing for nearly 800 years?
I don't know.
If those guys could nail all that stuff in like 15.
I genuinely don't know what was so easy for the Zhous that was so difficult for the Qins, but I guess things got lively. So then the Hans take over and the Han dynasty goes from 206 BCE to 220 CE. And it's considered, Ryan, a golden age of China.
Is it? Sure. Of course it is.
Now, during this period, Confucianism becomes the official state religion or way of life, I guess. This is the beginning of the Silk Road. This is a route from Asia to Europe and North Africa, East Africa. And that enables transfer of goods and ideas and, you know, livens things up a bit in general.
So was Confucius around then when Confucianism came in? Or is this like years later somebody picked up his work and went, this is good?
Yeah, Confucius actually lived during the Zhou dynasty. So he was centuries before in actual fact. But the Hans formalised it and made it official.
Right, so someone was hanging around in the library one day and went, hey, you read this book?
This book cool. is great. Let's do this.
Blew the dust off it. Yeah, okay.
So after the Han, there's a period known as the Three Kingdoms, which is in turn followed by a quite brief Sui dynasty. They were overthrown by the Tang dynasty. The Tang dynasty lasted from 618 to 906 CE and is often described as the greatest of the dynasties. In fact, some people called it a golden age of China.
Wait, the Tang, Qin and Han dynasties?
Well, yes, but these are spelt Tang rather than Tang.
Oh,
Han
okay.
without a D and Qin is Q-I-N. So we move then on to the Song dynasty. And then there's Mongol rule under the Yuan dynasty from 1279 to 1368 CE. Then we enter the Flash Gordon years where China was ruled by the Emperor Ming.
Ah, the merciless.
This is the Ming dynasty, 1368 starts. And we discussed that they beefed up the Great Wall of China. Although not enough, because in 1644 they were defeated by the Qings.
These related to the Qins?
These are different. They've got a G at the end.
Right, obviously.
The Qing dynasty was a cracker. They ruled from 1644 to 1911 CE, although the 19th and 20th centuries started to bring China into increasing conflict with Western powers.
That's incredible, isn't it? You think of Chinese dynasties as being quite ancient, and yet 1911, still there.
Not so very long ago. In 1911, the last of the Chinese emperors, Puyi, steps down, and China becomes a republic, marking the end of the whole dynasty business.
Do you think that was hard for him to do when he stood down?
Talk about end of an era right. that lasted literally thousands of years, and you're the one who's like, yeah, you'll always be remembered as the guy who lost it
right.
all.
You don't want to be that guy, do you?
You do not. But no. I guess he didn't have much of a choice.
No.
Now, the early 20th century is characterised by internecine conflict between Chinese nationalists, the Kuomintang under Chiang Kai-shek, and the Communist Party of Mao Zedong, who you may have heard of.
I have.
They have a short break in the hostilities between 1939 and 1945 in order for everyone to fight the invading Japanese.
Some say it was a golden age.
Yes, I've heard tell. Then after World War II, the conflict picks up again until 1949, when a victorious Chairman Mao declares victory and establishes the People's Republic of China.
And how were the people with this?
Well, at the time they were okay. However, the economics of communism didn't work out brilliantly for them. Mao declares a plan in 1958 called the Great Leap Forward. This was to increase industrial and agricultural production, get loads of food for everyone, collectivised all the land, organised farmers into communes. This was his brilliant idea.
How did that work out for him?
Well, that resulted in one of the largest famines in human history.
So not great?
No, an estimated 30 million people died from starvation in the years afterwards.
Good grief. Wow, that's a lot of people.
Really shocking. Amazing to think of that scale. And this is obviously also the period of the Cold War, when China is aligned with the USSR, not very friendly with the West. Although that does thaw a little in 1972, when Richard Nixon, of all people, visits China to establish relations between China and the United States.
And why did he do that?
Primarily, I would imagine it was trade-based. It is a massive, powerful country that ultimately want to be doing business with rather than chucking missiles at.
Possibly also to do with trying to bring another ally on side against the Russians?
No, I think part of it was actually he was hoping they would help negotiate a peace in the Vietnam at the time.
Gosh, it's all complicated, isn't it? World politics.
It's famously complex and not easy to master. Now, this 1979 sees the introduction of the one-child policy because they're trying to control their population growth.
Okay. They were having too many kids?
Yes, there were lots of kids. The population was exploding, so they restricted people to one child per family.
Okay.
Now, in the 1980s, there were economic reforms that freed the economy up a little bit to private enterprise. But also in 1989, Tiananmen Square was a massacre of protesting students. So not all love and rainbows.
Not a golden period.
In 1997, China takes control of Hong Kong back from the British. In 2007, China hosts the Olympics in Beijing, with the host nation nabbing 100 medals, 47 golds.
Hey, well, that's good. Good for them.
And today, after a modern period of really remarkable economic growth, China's economy overtook France, the UK, Germany and Japan. And in 2010, China became the world's second largest economy, behind only the United States.
But then you would perhaps expect it from a country its size.
Yes, with 1.4 billion people to put to work. If you get them going, I can imagine they're pretty potent. So all in all, economically, things are looking up. Freedom, not so much. Freedomhouse.org awards China a score of 9 out of 100, which it describes with some understatement as not free.
Oof.
Commenting,
right.
China's authoritarian regime has become increasingly repressive in recent years. So, as ever, our thoughts go to the people of China. We wish you economic success in the future and hopefully a bit more freedom and life in your days.
Golden ages to come.
Yes, to further golden ages.
Hi there. Thanks for coming out.
Oh, no problem. How can I help you?
Well, we were thinking about adding a gazebo.
Okay, nice. Now, how big were you thinking?
What do you mean?
Well, like 2,000 miles across? More?
Well, council regulations say it can be up to 6 feet across, so about that.
Oh, right. So we're going high. 5,000 feet?
No, just standard gazebo height, I think.
Well, you're not going to be able to see that from space, are you?
Well, and I think that's fine, to be honest. I mean, we really only need it for the odd picnic.
Right. Well, look, in that case, I don't really think I'm your man.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I mainly do great construction.
Ah, but it says no job too big or small in your advert.
Yeah, nah, that's an old advert, see? The new one is no job too great.
Oh.
Yep, I've done the Great Wall, a great army of soldiers made out of terracotta, and a great city I'm forbidden to tell you about, if you know what I mean. I've done them all.
Oh, well, that is interesting, because we have been calling it the Great Gazebo of China.
Oh, well, go on.
At least the greatest gazebo on this street.
Oh, I see. And it could be seen from...
Well, not space, obviously, but, certainly that hill over there, probably. I mean, birds will see it for sure.
Right. Well, in that case, construction of the great gazebo of this street starts on Monday.
Great.
Exactly. It will be. Just one question. What is a gazebo?
Okay, Peter. Well, look, I now know what China is, where China is, what its history is. But I tell you what I'm confused about is nutrition. How are you going to fit that into stories about China during the second century?
That is an excellent question, Ryan. A very, very excellent question.
Yes. So do tell us what on earth you have discovered.
Well, Ryan, look, first of all, nutrition, I don't think I really need to define, but for the record, it is the process of taking in and using food, or the scientific study of this. So we're talking about food and drink, basically. But I think it is probably worth digging a little bit into the 100 to 200 CE time period, because it's hard to pin things down, because as I said earlier, they tend to refer to the dynasty rather than the dates particularly. So our period is a Chinese history period known as the Han Dynasty, which ran from 206 BCE to 220 CE. But more specifically, we're looking at the Eastern Han. So the Han Dynasty started with the Western Han, so-called because its capital was in Chan'an, which is kind of the middle of modern China, but was to the west of ancient China.
Okay.
There was a bunch of infighting and rebellion. The empire was restored again by a new Han emperor named Liu Shu, and in AD 25, he became the emperor Guangwu. He moves the capital to Luoyang, which is a city of about 500,000 people at that time, about 400 kilometres to the east, hence the Eastern Han Dynasty.
We're oriented on the time and the place. This is good.
So it's during the Eastern Han that we find our first story. So we're going to start in 81 CE in a place called Nanyang, where a girl called Deng Sui was born to a noble family. Apparently she was able to read historical texts from the age of 6, and she absorbed the Analects, which are the writings of Confucius, by the age of 12.
She's a very smart little lady.
She was very smart. When she was 15, she went to the imperial palace. Fortunately not for a job or work experience. In fact, at 16, she becomes concubine to the emperor He.
And concubine means lover?
Yes, basically you're an official mistress. So saucy business, but you don't get to be a wife.
Okay. Is it like a job application, a CV you have to apply for that? Or is it just they see you in the street and like, you'll do?
I think you're a member of the right family. I think it's a relatively prestigious role. So she got shipped off. And the emperor himself, he was only 17 years old himself.
He was only.
He, yes. Now imagine my Googling of who was he. Now, he was only 17 years old, but he was still married. His wife was the Empress Yin, and she was apparently jealous of this tall, beautiful, smart, humble new arrival for some reason.
I wonder why.
Mysterious, isn't it?
Yeah.
In fact, it was quite a bad case of jealousy. When the emperor was ill, apparently, Empress Yin is claimed to have said, "If he dies, I'm going to have all of Deng Sui's family murdered."
She's a cheery chap, isn't
quite,
she?
Quite bad there, I think. But fortunately, on that occasion, the emperor recovered. And then on 102 CE, the emperor Ying and her grandmother were accused of using witchcraft to curse imperial consorts, so the various concubines, like and probably including Deng Sui.
Wow, using witchcraft.
Witchcraft, no one likes that. And as a result, Empress Yin was deposed, her father committed suicide, the rest of her family was exiled, and she didn't last much longer. She even died later that same year.
Oh, goodness. So, just goes to show, don't be jealous.
Exactly. And guess who was created empress to replace her?
The concubine.
Deng Sui, exactly. There's nothing to suggest it, but it's hard not to suspect she had something to do with all this. But I was Googling vigorously going, come on, really?
There must be something.
Nothing. Apparently, she was a humble, decent, lovely person, and everyone loved her.
It was just purely coincidence.
Purely just, well, karma, you might say.
Yeah.
But true to her humble self, the now Empress Deng refused all of the normal tributes that she would have gotten. All she asked for were annual gifts of ink and also supplies of a relatively recent invention on the scene, paper.
Yeah, because otherwise, what else are you going to do with the ink?
Well, previously they would write on bone or bamboo or wood. So paper was actually a new invention at that time, and her passion for paper and her official sanction of the use of paper may actually have been world-changing. By sponsoring the usage of paper, she's basically considered to be a key factor in the adoption of paper across the whole world.
Writing on paper must be leaps ahead of trying to write on a bone.
Yes,
Who has thought writing on a bone?
Well, yes, quite so, and bamboo strips are pretty heavy as well, so something you could fold up and put in your pocket must have been pretty eagerly adopted.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been like the latest Apple product.
Exactly. Everyone's queuing up for their piece of paper.
Yeah.
What did you get? White.
A4 Pro.
Ooh. Side note, she was also taught by Ban Zhao, who was China's first known female historian. So go the women in this story.
Yeah, absolutely. Apart from some.
Well, yes, that's true. In 106 CE, Deng Sui's husband, the Emperor He, he died. But fortunately, before he did that, he had two sons by, I could not find the names of the parents, but some of his concubines.
Were they called him and...
They.
They.
No, I didn't write their names down, but the younger one was decided to be more healthy, despite being only a few months old, and he was declared the emperor, and Deng Sui was consequently made the regent, because apparently not being 1 year old yet is too young to rule an empire.
I mean, arguably it is too young.
I can see that point. But it didn't last long, though. The new emperor only lived to 8 months old, and he was replaced by a relatively elderly 12-year-old relative.
Wow.
But that still leaves Deng in the role of the regent, so overall, as empress and regent, Deng Sui was basically in charge of China for 16 years. So in her time, she gave an amnesty to prisoners and she cut the cost of clothes and food in the palace. Was a pretty effective administrator, apparently. She cut down on corruption, even within her own family. But, Ryan, you're thinking, where's the nutrition come in?
Yes, I'm waiting for the nutrition.
Well, during her reign, she did a couple of things. One is she supported the development of water conservation. And what's more, when there were floods that devastated the area, Deng Sui is known to have basically organised disaster relief efforts, including tax remissions on farmers, donations to the poor, and in a direct act of nutrition, Ryan, she opened the imperial granaries to feed the hungry.
Right.
Now, the responsibility for nutrition of your subjects fits well with Deng's identity as a Confucian scholar, in fact. So the Chinese Confucian philosopher Mencius says, "As parents of a subject, when people starve to death, if they say, 'It's not my fault but the bad harvest,' how is that different from saying, 'It's not my fault but the weapon,' when one kills someone with a knife?" So the Confucian idea was you have a responsibility to your subject, and nutrition is a really critical part of that. Confucius himself stressed the importance of economic equality to maintain a stable and strong society. He's got a phrase called Huan Bu Jun, which can translate as fear not scarcity, fear inequality. But his analects also say the requisites of government are that there be sufficiency of food, sufficiency of military equipment, and the confidence of the people in their ruler. So overall, the point of bringing the Deng story is that actually nutrition is actually a key tenet of Confucian rule. So you have to make sure that your people have enough to eat in your role and responsibility as a ruler in the Confucian model.
Something Marie Antoinette never heard about.
She did not get that memo, no.
Let them eat cake.
As a side note, some of the things Confucius also had to say about food would look perfectly in place in a modern restaurant review, including: eat fresh and local. Know the origin of your food. Don't speak while eating.
No GMO.
Meat should be eaten in moderation.
That's true.
That's all modern stuff, right?
that genuinely is all sound advice, isn't it?
It really is. So
for
anyway,
nutrition.
So the point of all that being, Empress Deng is an example of a Confucian ruler, which nutrition is an important part of. She was a good ruler, and everyone views her as having been very effective, in large part due to her ensuring that her people were sufficiently nourished.
Amazing.
Now, unfortunately, it didn't end brilliantly for her. There were rebellions and uprisings that rocked the land. The Han Dynasty basically started to fall apart. In 121 CE, the Empress died at the age of 41, and she was buried beside her husband, the Emperor He.
I can only imagine 41's pretty good going in those days.
Let's call that a good innings.
I would say so, yeah. And through her ruling, perhaps she saved many people from dying early.
I think she did. So good on you, Deng Sui. You girl, bow before me and identify yourself.
Empress, I am Deng Sui.
The new washing up girl?
No, my lady.
Floor scrubber? Cleaner of the pig pen?
No, I am the new concubine to His Majesty, your husband.
Another one. Just terrific. Oh, and you're young and pretty too. I'm marvellous.
Confucius directs me away from pride in such things.
Ah, so you're educated as well. Bloody brilliant.
I seek only to pleasure the emperor, my lady.
Well, that is the job, I suppose.
Twice, three, four times a night, if that is his wish.
All right, all right. There's no need to go into all the details. Anyway, welcome to the palace, I suppose. I'll have a servant show you to your quarters.
Thank you, my lady. Soon, all of this will be mine.
What was that now?
Oh, I was just saying how all this will be fine.
Oh, right. Well, I suppose it will be.
Yes, my lady. And I'm going to have you killed.
What was that?
I'm gonna have you thrilled with my humility.
What?
Never mind. Where's that servant?
All right, Pete, that was a fascinating start to your nutrition in China journey. What's up next?
Well, Ryan, I'm going to introduce you to a new fruit.
All right.
It was a new fruit to me. I'm going to discover if it was new to you shortly. When I was researching for this podcast, I started to think, well, what did people in the Eastern Han Dynasty eat, right?
Panda.
Well, obviously, to most people, the first candidate is rice.
Yeah.
But actually, at this time, rice was not that common across the country. It was found in the south, but in the north, instead of rice, you'd find the grains proso millet and foxtail millet. Rice wasn't common at all.
So there's an alternate universe somewhere where rice never took off, and we ended up with that weird millet stuff instead.
Yeah, I had a look at the pictures of the millet, and rice looks nicer, I'll be honest. I decided I didn't want to talk about rice because it wasn't universal. So what about noodles? Well, this was a bit more encouraging because noodles definitely go that far back.
That really surprises me, by the way, that noodles go back further than rice. I would have said rice goes back to like early man.
Well, rice does, but it was only in the south of the country. So it's not that rice that didn't exist, but it just didn't cover my area sufficiently to make me feel comfortable talking about it.
I remain surprised.
That's fair enough. Now, in 2005, at an archaeological site, a place called Lija, this is bang in the middle of modern China, they discovered a pot.
Whoa.
I know, as if this was unusual. Well, this pot was buried upside down, and what had happened was the soil had kind of sealed the neck of the pot as a result.
Okay.
So when they opened it up, inside the pot, they find some thin yellow strands of something.
Right.
On closer examination, they turn out to be strands.
What could it be?
I know, maybe spoilers. The strands are actually made of foxtail and proso millet, the millet that we were talking about, along with some other grain pressed into noodles. And these noodles were dated to 4,000 years ago, so it's about 2000 BC, making them the world's oldest noodles.
Did they have a little nibble? I feel like I would
knowledge.
Have a little nibble. Like, if you discover that, wouldn't you have just a little nibble to see what a 4,000-year-old noodle tasted like?
I think part of your training is to not eat the specimens that you find, but your mileage may vary. I don't know. Possibly they had a nibble, but they can't tell anyone, can they?
Don't people eat those 100-year-old eggs and stuff?
100-year eggs are a thing. That's something we could talk about in the verdict. But yes, I think that 4,000-year-old noodles, not a nutritious snack.
Mm.
They didn't even know they were noodles when they saw them at first, so there's that.
Just have a little nibble.
Anyway, I discovered this and I thought I'm onto something with noodles, and the earliest written record of noodles is found in a dictionary from the Eastern Han period.
Ah, very good. What did it say?
Well, I discovered that noodles were made from wheat dough and they became a prominent food for the people of the Han dynasty. And at the time, noodles were referred to as cake, apparently, which was a bit of a catch-all used for any food made with flour and water.
Okay.
Yeah, side note, when the noodles were cooked in soup, it was called soup cake, which just sounds so wrong to me.
Yes. Yeah. Unless you're getting soup first and then cake afterwards.
Yeah,
I have that.
Soup cake, no.
Soup cake, no.
But then I kind of ran out of road on noodles as well, other than to find people ate them. End of story, really.
Not much nutrition in a noodle, I'd imagine.
Well, they'll keep you going. The grains will keep you going for a while.
Yeah, I suppose.
Carrots. Carrots were another dead end, Ryan. They came much later to China than this, but I am mentioning them now so that I can observe that the Chinese for carrot is barbarian radish.
Yeah, that's good. That says a lot about where they found it.
Yes, well, this didn't fit in my time period, but I had to bring it to the table. That made me laugh.
Anyway, barbarian radish to my table.
As I continue my research, this one thing that came up over and over and over again was this fruit I'd never heard of called jujube.
Jujube? Never heard of it.
I had never heard of it either, and it kept coming up, jujube. And apparently the oldest collection of Chinese poems, called Xi Jing, or the Book of Songs, contains poems written from the 11th to 7th centuries BCE, and it includes the sentence, jujube fruit picked in August and rice harvested in October.
It's a motto I live by.
Indeed, right? Then closer to our time, jujube fruit were found, amongst other foods, in the tomb of Lady Di. This was a Han dynasty noble who died in about 168 BCE. And her body was so well preserved, an autopsy revealed she suffered from heart problems caused by poor nutrition. In this case, a diet too rich in sugars and meats.
Yeah, that's the problem, isn't it, when you get rich and wealthy?
Yeah, exactly. Now, in our time, the Shenong Benkao Jing, this was somewhere between 300 BC and 200 AD, which is a book that translates rather brilliantly as Shenong's Herbal Classics.
Also be a good album.
Exactly. Now, Shenong, by the way, is a legendary emperor who supposedly taught humans the art of the plough and various other agricultural knowledge. He's also known as the Divine Farmer or the Divine Husbandsman. So if you had his book, you knew it was good stuff. But So this book, Shenong's Herbal Classics, lists this fruit, jujube, as one of the superior herbal medicines that are harmless to humans with medicinal benefits.
Sounds good. Jujube.
It's also worth noting that cannabis is also on this list of noble or upper herbs. So anyway, everywhere I looked, this jujube fruit kept coming up, and I was like, how have I never heard of this fruit? So it turns out that jujube, A, it's real, and it's something of a super fruit. This is Ziziphus jujuba, also known as the red date or the Chinese date, and it's actually one of the oldest cultivated fruit trees in the world.
Okay, this isn't jojoba.
It could be jojoba, couldn't it?
Jojoba's a thing, right?
Yeah, it could be. We'll look into that. Bring that to the verdict as well. We're stacking up the verdict stuff, aren't we? Now, jujube is still cultivated today, but 95% of the grown jujube is in China, where it actually provides the income for about 20 million farmers. How have we not heard of this fruit, Ryan?
Because I guess they just eat it in China.
I guess so. It's during the Han Dynasty that large-scale cultivation of the fruit started. They included the appointment of special officials to regulate the production of the fruit. It's excellent for farmers because, A, it gets started really quick. Apparently, it could even bear fruit in its first year. So you plant it and or graft it, and it will start bearing fruit that year. And it can get high yields, so properly working out, in just 3 or 5 years.
That is super handy if you have a big population to feed.
If you're in a rush, you can get these going. It also basically prunes itself. The fruit-bearing shoots just fall off in autumn, and secondary shoots die back each year, so you don't have to spend ages chopping it down. More importantly than all of that, it's really tolerant of drought and salinity and dodgy soil, doesn't need a lot of water, so it's really useful for farmers in marginally fertile areas.
This is an amazing fruit.
I know, and yet we'd never heard of it. And it's really good for you. It's high in nutrients, including vitamin C and B, potassium, iron and zinc.
Right.
It's a rich source of polysaccharides, triterpenic acids, flavonoids, alkaloids and polyphenols, all of which are apparently good antioxidant things, which are good for you, I'm told. And culturally, it's got really positive meanings in Chinese culture. Sweet life, flourishing business, fertility, harmony and happiness.
That's amazing. How have we not heard of this?
I'm just shocked that I don't know about it. Apparently, it's unsurprisingly used extensively in traditional Chinese medicine. So it's used to calm the mind, it's used as an aid to sleep, and also apparently can help with constipation.
Well, that's good. This is an incredible fruit.
It really is, and I thought I'd check, actually, is that traditional Chinese medicine, or is it true? I looked at WebMD and it said, hey, antioxidants might indeed prevent or delay certain types of cell damage. So there's that. Also, there is some evidence for the sleep promoting properties of the fruit. And there was a small study, at least one small study, that took liquid jujube extract, and that did indeed improve constipation symptoms in patients compared to a placebo. So yeah, it seems to actually do all these things.
The constipation thing I get, there's a lot of fiber in fruit, isn't there, that'll help you pass waste.
Fruits in general are supposedly good for that, aren't they? So, but side note, you may actually want to avoid eating jujube, though, if you're taking antidepressant drugs such as venlafaxine. It might interact with that, and also some seizure medication. So if you are on medication and you're thinking, oh, I'm going to have this fruit, check first, please, rather than take my word for it. But if you're not on drugs, maybe you can having trouble sleeping, or you having trouble with other functions, maybe it's time to get yourself a nice big bag of jujube.
Snack on a jujube. Nice.
Monsieur Martin, what is this delicious new fruit I am trying here?
It is called jujube.
Jujube?
Jujube.
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 Ah, enough of this. I want an hamburger. A hamburger!
Well, Peter, you have served us up a treat with a couple of delicious stories. Is there any more nutritional content in your script in front of you?
Well, yes, fine. There is in my script in front of me. It says here, nutrition in Chinese medicine.
Nice.
Because in Chinese medicine, traditionally, and really in medicine today, nutrition and medicine are very much hand in hand. What you eat and drink very much affects your health, and herbs and spices are medicinal in various ways. So I'm going to talk a bit about medicine in the Eastern Han Dynasty.
Okay, tell me.
So at that time, there was a Chinese pharmacologist, physician, inventor and writer who made a major contribution to the development of traditional Chinese medicine, and his name was Zhang Zhongjing.
Sounds almost made up, but okay.
It does a little bit, doesn't it? But I did check. He was born in a place called Nanyang in central China, and he lived from 150 to 219 CE. Bang, our time period.
Perfect.
Now, not much is known about his life, unfortunately, other than A, he studied medicine, and B, it said he invented Chinese stuffed dumplings.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
How about that?
Supposedly, he went back to his ancestral village during the winter, and he found a bunch of the villagers were suffering from frostbite, in particular around their ears.
Huh.
So to treat this, he cooks up a bunch of mutton and chili lily and healing herbs. He wraps them in scraps of dough and he folds them to look like little ears and he boils them and he hands them out to his neighbours. Now, my guess is it didn't really help the frostbite, but when your prescribed medicine is delicious dumplings, you're going to go back to that doctor, aren't you?
Yeah.
Anyway, Zhang writes a book covering all the things he's learned about medicine entitled Jingui Yao Lui, which translates rather beautifully as Essential Prescriptions from the Golden Cabinet. Now, I don't know why, but he wrote it during the Eastern Han, but apparently it was first published in the Northern Song Dynasty, and the original has been lost to us, so it's been referred to since the oldest known copy from 1340 CE, which was the early Ming Dynasty. But we have it. We've got copies, so we know it exists. And in his book, he makes a clear link, unsurprisingly, between nutrition and health. He says, ingredients with a sour taste function on the liver, scorched and bitter drugs function on the heart, and sweet ingredients function on the spleen. And he also recommends for good health a moderate diet with bitter, sour, pungent, and sweet flavours.
Yeah, you've got to wonder whether or not he actually was making that bit up, or whether or not just over the course of his experimentation, he discovered that that was the case.
Yeah, it's a lot of what he writes is not necessarily things he's invented. He picked it up. There's a lot of articulation of traditional and folklore medicines. One of the things she says is, when a patient eats foods he likes, he's likely to recover quickly. Which kind of brings us back to the dumpling situation, doesn't it?
That's right. Yeah.
So, side note though, if you are going to him, you are taking a risk, you might not get dumplings, because one of his other prescriptions is a treatment that really jumped out at me when I flicked through his book, which says one must fumigate the anus.
Right.
I was hoping for dumplings.
Or I came for the fumigation and all I got was dumplings.
Either way, someone's going home disappointed. Now, of course, in the book I found a bunch of different prescriptions. All of the recipes included the use of our friend the jujube fruit.
Ah, of course, good old jujube.
Now, throughout the book, balance is a really important concept, and it's true in traditional Chinese medicine as a whole. So Zhang talks about yin and yang, which I'm sure you've heard of.
I have.
So apparently diseases of a yang nature include headache, pains in the neck, spine, arm, and referred pain in the foot, whereas diseases of a yin nature include cough, nausea, abdominal issues, and heart stroke.
And for those people that aren't aware of what yin and yang is, though, Pete?
Well, they're sort of balanced opposing forces. I think it's used in multiple ways, but fundamentally they're things that have to remain in balance, and if you have too much of either of them, things are not great. A bit like the Force in Star Wars.
A bit like two pandas circling each other.
A little bit, actually. Disturbingly, your obsession with pandas is beginning to worry me. But he, as well as yin and yang, he talks about the concepts of heat and cold in the body, which is quite connected to yin and yang, but it's a bit similar. So this is a concept that first appeared, actually, in our old friend, the book Shenon Benkao Jin. This is the notion in Chinese medicine of heating and cooling foods. So I don't mean you heat and cool foods. This is the nature of certain foods, and it doesn't even refer to their actual temperature. But it is thought that certain foods are either heating to your body or cooling for your body. So foods that have a warming nature would be like beef, coffee, ginger, chilies, and fried foods. Mm-hmm. So they don't have to be hot themselves, but they make you feel hot. Cooling foods, a salad, yogurt, fruits, beer, that kind of thing.
That all makes sense to me.
It does, right? So the idea is you maintain a balance of heating and cooling foods in your life. You respond to excesses of heat and cold in your body with the opposing foods.
Find balance in your meals. Exactly. That's good.
So, yeah, you might believe in traditional Chinese medicine, or you might be Paul Dursley and be sceptical. But I think whatever you feel, you have to admit that aiming for a balanced diet is pretty good advice for everybody, from the Eastern Han Dynasty right through to today.
I agree.
So that's it, Ryan. That is Deng Shui feeding the people, jujube fruit for health, and early Chinese nutritional theory. That is nutrition in China between 100 and 200 CE.
Well done, Peter.
Thanks, mate.
Pat yourself on the back. Pat yourself on the chin. Nice one, Pete.
Thanks, mate.
All right, so what's the diagnosis, Doc?
Well, the bad news is that your body is suffering an excess of heat, but it's easily treated by consuming cold foods twice a day until you're better.
Oh, so what, like the leftover chicken from yesterday?
No, that is a hot food.
Ah, but it's been in the fridge, so it's cold.
But still, it's a hot food.
Okay, fine. I'll just have a salad.
Ah, yes, that is cold.
Great. So lettuce, cucumber and tomato it is.
No tomato. That is hot.
I'm sorry, what?
Tomato is hot.
But if it's in a salad, it's cold.
No, you misunderstand. Cold tomato is a hot food.
Yeah, look, I don't think I'm getting this, Doc. Lettuce is cold.
Correct.
Cucumbers are cold.
Absolutely.
Onions are cold.
No.
Wait, what?
Onions are hot.
Wait, so a cold salad is cold?
Correct.
But not if it has onions?
Or tomatoes.
Right, look, chili powder is hot, right?
Of course.
And fish?
Cold.
Off the grill?
Cold.
It's just been cooked?
Cold.
What? I mean, that makes no sense at all!
Well, an alternative would be to consider your yin and yang.
Okay.
In this, you simply take this suppository and shove it right up your yin and yang.
Hot or cold? All right, Peter. Well, look, there you go. Another episode down, and the eyes of the audience swivel in their sockets towards me. Because guess what? It's my time for a dursalation.
Let's dursalate.
All right, turn it on.
Oh, I love this bit. Okay, I'm going to pull the lever. Okay, your place is Oceania.
Oceania?
Oceania. I think it's a real place.
Okay.
All right. Your time period is 1644 to 1912.
Oh, that's a good solid range.
It is. Did you know that's the Qing dynasty?
I did, because you told us earlier.
Yeah, like you remembered. Come on.
Not at all. Qing dynasty. Okay, that's cool. Stuff was written down. That's a good thing.
And your topic is Mind the Gap.
I'm sorry, what?
It's Mind the Gap.
Mind the Gap.
So for our international listeners, Mind the Gap is an announcement that happens on the London Underground tube trains, telling you not to fall into the gap between the train and the platform.
Right.
You're going to have to be creative, let's face it, unless there's a tube train across Oceania.
Okay. All right. I mean, sure. Mind the Gap in Oceania during 1644 to 1912.
Easy.
Right. All right, I'll bring you something, Pete. Don't you worry.
I'm excited.
All right. Well, look, there you go. With that dursalation complete, that is the show for this week. So thank you all for listening. If you'd like to get in touch about any of the things that Pete has told us about this week, or just to say hello, you can reach out to us through our website at hhepodcast.com or by email at peteandryan@hhepodcast.com.
That's right. We'd love to hear from you. And you never know, you might end up featured on a future show.
That's right. If you're on Mastodon, Instagram, Facebook, or X, you can find us at hhepodcast.
And if you subscribe to those, you'll get an alert every time we post extra content, facts we didn't use, pictures, photos, and other bits and pieces.
Pictures of hands, chins, and other bodily parts.
Body part dynasties.
But we are going to be back again soon with
The Verdict.
But until then, a huge thanks to you, Peter.
Thanks to you, Ryan.
And that's it. I guess all that's left to say is
you've been listening to
History Happened Everywhere.
Hey, Ryan.
Hey, Pete.
Why are you looking so happy?
Because I am the GOAT.
The greatest of all time?
No, I checked my birth year and it turns out I was born in the Chinese year of the GOAT. And I love goats.
Oh, that is interesting, in fairness.
Yeah, and I found yours too.
Well, obviously, I'm a dragon.
No, you're not actually.
I'm a phoenix?
That's not one of them.
Ah, serpent.
No.
Lion.
Also not one of them.
Tiger.
No.
Charizard.
No.
Fine, I give up. What am I?
Well, you, Peter, are a rat.
Oh.
Good, right?
Is it?
Yeah, and I thought that you, as a rat, would love rats.
Well, that's not true at all, is it? I absolutely hate rats. They're gross.
So anyway, long story short, the flat is now infested with rats.
What?
You're welcome.
Ryan, they're everywhere. Oh, my God.
Happy Chinese New
Year,
Peter.
They've got the fridge. Oh, they're in my shoes. This is horrible. Oh, I can hear them squeaking. They're scratching. What are they nibbling on? They're nibbling. Oh, that's my... Oh, that was my best suit. Why have they done this? Why have you done this, Ryan? I hate you. Bring back that cheese.
Ah,
I'm a big Fan Bing Bing fan. I'm a big Fan Bing Bing fan. I know I am. I'm sure I am. I'm a big Fan Bing Bing fan.
He's a big Fan Bing Bing fan.
Oh, dear. All right. Thanks, everyone.
We had a good time, even if you didn't. It's not about you.
I'm back out.